You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, July 22nd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Bob Ivory, author of The Seven Sins of Wall Street, The Big Banks, Their Washington Lackeys, and The Next Big Financial Crisis. Also on the program today, Hall Big Drops. The Hall Big versus Burwell case has now been ruled upon. What will it mean for Obamacare? Also on the program, 1,000 National Guardsmen from Texas to head to the border to do nothing. Yes. It's July. It's time to get, time to move. Meanwhile, in Israel, over 500 Palestinians dead. 30 Israelis, most of whom are military personnel. Some reflections on Netroots from yours truly and the controversy involving Daily Kos attendance next year. And I will address questions as to whether or not I am anti-Semitic, brought up on Facebook in the context. I really wanted to take a day away from talking about what's happening with Israel and Palestine, but it's just
if I may, a man's got to do.
A man's got to do what a man's got to do, in the words of Bibi Netanyahu. We don't have the sound actually, but I wanted to pull Deval Patrick. Very impressively agreed to take at least 1,000 children in. Tens of thousands who have basically handed themselves over to our border officials in hopes of getting asylum. And sadly, it's not the case that governors across the country are showing that level of, I mean, I don't even know why we need to say bravery. The idea of 1,000 kids coming into your state. Oh, my God. Terrifying. Terrifying. All right. We will get to all this and more. But first, let's take a break. We'll come back and we will be talking to Bob Ivory.
Your mind.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome Bob Ivory. He is a financial journalist and staff reporter for Bloomberg News and author of The Seven Sins of Wall Street, Big Banks, Their Washington Lackeys, and The Next Financial Crisis. Welcome to the program, Bob.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me on.
So your book breaks down the seven sins of Wall Street in the sort of the classic seven sins of gluttony, wrath, envy, pride, lust, sloth, and greed. You can almost take those. Good for them, I guess, for exhibiting all seven. That must have made it a little bit easier. But let's go back and talk about just in general, I guess. This is an indictment of, I guess, an entire sector of our economy, one that is growing and that has grown precipitously over the years. I mean, just give us the broader sense of how those sins are exhibited in Wall Street.
I think what we, if we ever could hearken back to a glory day for American finance, Sam, it was that they have the money. So where are they going to put the money? They're going to put the money where they can make money. And there can be a combination of making money and doing good, where you have investments in infrastructure, for instance, that pay off really well and that can also help society. So the allocation of capital used to be a primary function of American finance. What happened in the last generation is that making money for making money's sake became the end. And it was not a means to an end, it was the end. And that was the sole or at least the paramount objective of American finance, and that really that became in my eyes the sin of pride, and that's the one that's really overarching all of them. Without excessive pride, you don't really get the other six sins.
What do you think? I mean, I want to get into the details of just how they were enabled, I guess, or what systemically created or allowed for that those sins, I guess, or those impulses to take over. But what do you think in general? I mean, in terms of like the culture of Wall Street, I mean, I guess to a certain extent, it's a broader reflection on our culture in general. But what for you, what marked that turn and what do you think drove it?
Well, the book is about the Seven Sins of Wall Street. It's about what's happened since the financial crisis. So what I really do is I say the financial crisis was really a turning point, and that was we could have gone either way. We could have said, hey, the financial sector of the country and of the world is getting bigger than it should be. It's more important than it should be, and it's certainly greedier than it should be. Let's do something about that. But what happened instead was the financial sector of the world was rewarded for bringing us to the brink of financial catastrophe. And that's really what the book is about. I'd have to say that the 2008 financial crisis is a huge turning point in the history of the world, in the history of our country, because it showed that the banks only got bigger and their influence only got bigger. And they were able to, after the crisis, really almost literally write the laws that governed them. This is unprecedented. Certainly after the last big financial crisis back in the 30s, this did not happen. And we were rewarded. The country, the United States, was rewarded with, what, about 60 years of relative peace and calm in the financial, maybe 70 years of peace and calm in the financial industry. But this time around, 2008, didn't happen at all. And since the crisis, we've seen the behavior of the bigger banks really not improve at all.
Right. Well, I mean, I want to get into that, but leading up to that, I mean, you obviously you spend time with these folks. You have a sense of sort of what the 2008, I think, revealed that We as a society, we're not going to do anything about this. These problems that led up to 2008. But what do you think? What happened? You talk about there was a time where finance functioned with some measure of social utility. What happened that allowed it not to? Or, I mean, in other words, this desire just to make money regardless of its social utility, was that always there and it was kept in check, or did something change?
I think there was, I'm not that old, Sam, but, you know, I can't remember the 30s, but I do remember, I actually am getting pretty old, and I do remember when people used to feel ashamed of their behavior, and I seem like a grumpy old man when I even bring up the subject, you know? It's like the... every Christmas, my wife loves to watch with the kids the Charlie Brown Christmas, and there's always that scene with Linus, and he starts talking about the commercialization of Christmas. I don't know if you've seen that show. It's on every December, and Linus is going on and on about how bad it is that Christmas is so commercialized. You know how old and quaint that talk sounds today?
Right.
Nobody ever brings that up, and I know it's a little off topic, but it's kind of a piece, you know, where you have the whole idea of morality, and I'm not a moralist, and I'm far from it, but you know what, the whole idea that people should feel ashamed of their behavior, it's just so old-fashioned now. When was the last time, you know, a public figure actually said, I'm ashamed of what I did, or I'm ashamed of what you did, I'm ashamed of what we did? That, I think, was the turning point. The last time somebody in a position of power came out and said, you know what I did was shameful.
Yeah, I mean, it's a topic that we've talked about on this program, that there was a turn at one point, and I imagine we're... I may very well be a little bit older than you, but something certainly happened at one point within our society where that element of just, you know, what is my role as a citizen in this really went out the window, or a member of society. It really was just get what you can while you can get it, and that certainly happened. All right, but let's talk about... what happened after the crisis? Give us your sense. Well, first, actually, let's talk about Dick Bowen. You talk about him in the book. Who is Dick Bowen? Why is he relevant to your story?
I'm glad you brought him up because Bill Black, the banking professor in Kansas City, who worked on prosecuting the SNL villains, has brought up the fact that Dick Bowen is a hero, and we knew Dick Bowen was a hero before, but Dick Bowen, even more so, is a hero. The Justice Department has just gotten a huge settlement from Citigroup for bad mortgages that they were peddling, and Dick Bowen is really the first guy who raised his hand and said he worked for Citigroup, he worked for City Mortgage, and part of his job was making sure that the mortgages that crossed his desk were and the desk of the 200 people that worked for him were well underwritten and had all the paperwork and had all the T's crossed. And Dick Bowen raised his hand and said, listen, we're getting $60 billion worth of mortgages coming across our desk, and 60 to 80% of these are not good. And this was in 2007. And he found himself without a job. They shunted him to a new job where he, instead of supervising 200 people, he supervised two. And then within a year, he was gone from Citigroup. And he really is the guy that risked everything and certainly sacrificed his career in the mortgage industry because he raised his hand and said, listen, there are problems here at Citigroup. And that was before the subprime crisis that contributed a lot to the collapse in 2008.
And so let's talk about that Citigroup settlement. I mean, give me your assessment of it, because it seems like this is, you know, a small cost of doing business. And they ended up basically getting a broader immunity for a lot of the work that they did about CDOs. And we just don't know really what they did at this point because of the nature of the settlement.
There's, you know, after the collapse in 1929, the Pecora Commission, headed by Ferdinand Pecora, really got to the root of a lot of the problems that preceded that collapse. We have the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, which was really kind of did its work with one hand tied behind its back, with political constraints and things like that, and. We'll never really get to the bottom of it. I'll give you a fresh perspective on the Citigroup settlement. Now, they did settle for billions of dollars. It was not a small amount of money, and it certainly hurt them. But what I'll tell you is this: it concerned their behavior before the crisis. What I am concerned about is their behavior after the crisis. I spoke to a whistleblower who used to work for Dick Bowen. Her name is Sherry Hunt. She's chapter one of the Seven Sins of Wall Street, her story. She worked at the City Mortgage Facility in O'Fallon, Missouri, and she actually supplied Dick Bowen with a lot of the data that he used to go to Citigroup and say, hey, you know, there's a big problem. Now, that she started that in 2005. She collected data all the way to 2012 when she and the federal government won a lawsuit against Citigroup for defrauding the U.S. government through the mortgages, by saying that mortgages were good when they weren't. And what the government said in its lawsuit, and Citigroup, one thing that the banks don't do, Sam, is they don't, when they settle lawsuits like this, they rarely say, we did it. They can evade any kind of admission of guilt or innocence and still settle, and most of them do that. In this case, Citigroup said, we're guilty. We defrauded the U.S. government. They paid about $170 million, which is not a lot of money in the general scheme of Wall Street. But what the lawsuit said was that Citigroup hadn't fixed their problems all the way to 2012. Now, the billions of dollars they settled for recently was for pre-2008. They continued to defraud the government from 2008, from the time that lawsuit, the time period that that lawsuit covers, to 2012. And in 2012, the government said they still hadn't fixed it. So my question is, here we are in 2014. Mortgages almost brought down Wall Street. Certainly Citigroup would be the first to pitch off that cliff. And they still hadn't learned their lesson. They still were not carefully underwriting the mortgages, and they were still defrauding the U.S. government in 2012. And we don't know between then and now whether they're still doing it. That is a huge problem.
And just to be clear, when you say defrauding the government, it's because they're securitizing or passing on the loans that they know are subpar and are to be backed by the federal government.
Government guarantees, that's right. It would be either the Federal Housing Authority, the FHA, which is what they settled on. Sherry Hunt had also found Fannie and Freddie, which are the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are the two mortgage guarantee companies that are run by the federal government. She had also found a lot of fraud there. But what they had settled on in 2012 was just the Federal Housing Authority mortgages.
So is it the point that they didn't learn their lesson? I mean, it's also arguable as to whether or not they didn't learn their lesson. It's just not a lesson that we wanted them to learn, right? I mean, isn't arguably the lesson, if you guys get in trouble, don't worry, we got you covered?
I think you're right, Sam. I think you're right. I've been talking like a school marm here. You know, right and wrong, and you didn't learn your lesson. But actually, we can't only blame the banks for their behavior. We can't say it's just the banks. It is the government as well. The government is enabling them to do this. The government, you know, all of us work on incentive. If we have the right incentive to do the right thing, chances are we will do the right thing. If we have incentive to do the wrong thing, we might do the wrong, we might be more disposed to doing the wrong thing. So what the government has set up now is a system where you have what's called moral hazard, and that is defined simply that if I make money, it's mine. If I lose money, it's the taxpayers.
Right.
And moral hazard says I can go out and do whatever I want because I got nothing to lose. And that's kind of the kind of system we've set up right now. And Wall Street simply is behaving according to the incentives that are in front of them.
Right. And or the lack, I guess, of disincentives that the government could construct. I mean, when you look at Dodd-Frank, how does Dodd-Frank not do the job of disincentivizing, I guess, this sort of behavior?
Well, I like to say that the Obama administration never saw a problem it didn't want to throw a committee at. There's new layers of bureaucracy, and there's complicated rules on things like how much money on how much money the banks can borrow compared to how much money they've got sitting in the bank in their vaults. And there's a lot of details that are being left up to regulators who are now being lobbied by the banks. I think what the point that Dodd-Frank misses is that and it almost seems too simple, and it probably is, because, you know, quite frankly, Sam, the stuff that we're talking about, the solutions that we would be talking about are probably politically dead. You just couldn't in any, you know, especially now, couldn't maybe in, you know, in early 2009, we could have said, you know, instead of setting up this huge new bureaucratic apparatus to oversee Wall Street, if we just say banks shouldn't be, have over $500 billion in assets, and therefore they can do what they want lawfully within the law, and if they stumble and fail, then their shareholders would suffer, and their bondholders would suffer, the employees certainly, and the executives, but the taxpayers wouldn't. Perhaps we had a window in 2009 to do that. Now, however, I don't think that we can do that. What we're really talking about is what the prevailing regulatory regime calls for is for regulators to be on the watch. And I don't know about you, but regulators, financial regulators, have shown me over the last 10 years or so that they can't be trusted either. I'm not saying they're not hardworking and underpaid and they want the best for themselves and the country, but they've just done a bad job, and I don't trust them. I don't trust the regulators, and I don't trust the banks. So what do? We have to, in my eyes, set up a structure where the banks can fail. And when they fail, they don't threaten to bring down the global financial system with them. The only way to do that is to have smaller banks. And like I say, I think that the chances of that happening are pretty slim right now.
Right. And so basically what you're saying is that at the time, and, you know, frankly, this is these were arguments that you would hear from even the Occupy Wall Street banking committee, was that to attempt to do this on a smaller sort of regulatory scheme as opposed to a big structural changes was going to be problematic, not the least of which you're talking about regulators who, I mean, I don't know that, frankly, there's anyone who can really understand what these banks are doing. It doesn't seem to me that the banks themselves are quite aware of what they're doing half the time. We need – so what you're arguing is for some type of regime like a Glass-Steagall type of regime where we simply minimize the damage that these banks can inflict on the broader economy in the event that they that we cannot rein in their practices, you know, beyond capital requirements and whatnot.
I think that yes, the short answer is yes. I'll give you a slightly longer answer, and that is that I think that the banks should be free to take risks. I think that risk is a good thing most of the time, done properly.
It's really, we need risk in finance. We need freedom to invest or to put money where smart people, for the most part, want to put it. What we don't need is the taxpayer backing that up. There's no real other industry. Well, I think maybe gas and oil is an industry, too, that has a lot of backing from the government. But let's slice the bureaucracy down. Let's make it, listen, who benefits the most from complication and opaqueness? The bad guys do. The bad guys are the ones that benefit from a lack of transparency. The more bureaucracy you have, the more rules you have. And I don't know who's counting the pages of Dodd-Frank. Some people have said it's 800 pages. It depends, I guess, on whether you double space or how you print it out. But it's big. And it's complicated. And that, in the end, only benefits the bad guy.
And so, I mean, what do you see would be the proper sort of like structural overhaul? Would it be to separate commercial and investment banking? Should we go further? I know we're not in an opportunity. The opportunity does not exist now, but your subtitle does talk about the next financial crisis. And, you know, now is the, you know, they say that the best time to get a good lawyer is when you don't need one. Maybe this is the best time to get a good answer for what to do about the banks before the next crisis.
Right. One of the things that the banks and their industry groups say is, you know, if we had Glass-Steagall, it wouldn't have prevented the last financial crisis. I disagree with them, but I'm not going to argue with them. I'm not going to argue with them about the last financial crisis. I think that a form of Glass-Steagall will help prevent the next financial crisis. And that's really what we should be focused on. The last financial crisis happened. The next one is still, at this late stage, preventable. There's been a couple of attempts in the Senate to limit the amount of assets a financial institution can hold. In both of them, Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio was involved. In the first one, he had a co-sponsor in Senator Ted Kaufman of Delaware, who's no longer in the Senate. In the second attempt, and I think it's still pending, he has a Republican. Sherrod Brown is a liberal Democrat. In his second effort, he's got a conservative Republican. I guess there's no other kind at this point. He's got a Republican senator from Louisiana, David Vitter, who is his co-sponsor. You do have some bipartisan support for limiting the amount of assets a financial institution can have. What Sherrod Brown and David Vitter have proposed, I believe, is $500 billion. Now, that would only mean that six banks in the United States would need to sell divisions, units of themselves, or sell off assets in order to get down below that $500 billion figure. Those are Wells Fargo, JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, and I believe Morgan Stanley. I could take a quick look at Morgan Stanley on my Bloomberg terminal, and see if they're still there. They might not even be there. So you only have those six banks that are bigger than $500 billion. One thing I do want to add, though, is that a lot of the function that the big banks, the functions that the big banks used to do, are now migrating towards what is nicknamed the shadow banking system, and that's the hedge funds and the buyout firms, and a lot of the I don't think that that's such a bad thing, because you don't have, for instance, J.P. Morgan losing at least $6 billion on a bad trade in London. It's called the London Whale,
right.
and that being deposit money. You don't have the hedge funds rolling the dice with grandma's deposit money, and that's not such a bad thing.
I mean, how big, if those banks were to divest in such a way that they were under $500 billion, I mean, how How much would they have to sell off? I mean, give me, are they? You mentioned that Goldman Sachs may be just above that threshold. The rest, I mean, are we talking about entities that would be half the size at that point? And then, as a subsidiary question, how much exposure do we have from the shadow banking industry? In other words, we don't have a direct government backstop, but can they create a domino effect where we have a serious shock to our financial system?
I'll take the first question first, because I have some data in front of me. I just called it up. Morgan Stanley has $800 billion in assets. I believe. Oh wait, I've got to get the timing here right, the years right. J.P. Morgan Chase has $2.5 trillion in assets. That's a number. I'm a little surprised at that number. I didn't think it was that big. I haven't looked in a while. $2.5 trillion in assets. Just to give you an idea, in the fourth quarter of 2008, they had $2.1 trillion. So, you know, that's the Federal Reserve has four. And the Federal Reserve is the biggest and most powerful financial or institution in the world. I'm kind of floored by that, actually. I didn't believe that the number was so big. That's huge. And you can see the growth from 2008 to 2014. Like I said, Morgan Stanley is the smallest of the six with $801 billion. So in the case of J.P. Morgan, you have more than breaking it down, more than half its size. To answer your second question, yeah, I believe there's a lot of problems in the hedge funds, and what do we do about them? Well, in one sense, we've solved the problem of inadvertently, I suppose, or an unintended consequence that from the financial regulation from Dodd-Frank is that the hedge funds are now doing the wild trading that the big banks used to do. And yeah, there can be a domino effect. And I do quote Jamie Dimon, who is the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase in my book, I believe in the introduction. And he said, you know, his daughter called him from college in 08 and she said, "Dad, what's a financial crisis?" And he said, "Oh, something that happens every seven years." So, you know, I'm not that good at math, but I could add 7 to 2008 and come up with 2015. I think that there, and my colleagues at Bloomberg News are doing a great job at identifying some of the weak points in the financial system right now that might come back to bite us in 2015. And it's a lot of, if you'd like me to go into it a little bit, I will.
Please.
Okay, so what you have is an endless bailout of the banks in the United States. The Federal Reserve never stopped bailing out the banks through very low interest rates and what's called quantitative easing, right. And which was basically the purchase of bonds to the tune, I believe, at the peak was $85 billion a month. And they've since tapered down what they've bought every month. But what this ended up doing was injecting a heck of a lot of money into the system. Because every time the Federal Reserve buys a bond, it buys it with cash, and the cash goes to the dealer, which is a bank. So the banks have all this money, and there's all this money sloshing around. Because of the low interest rates, pension funds, insurance companies, and individual investors can't get the return that they are used to. Now, if you're, you know, anybody with a savings account knows what I'm talking about. In 2009, 10, 11, 12, ever since the low interest rate in December 2008, the amount of return you get from, let's say, a money market fund or a certificate of deposit or even a savings account is just almost minuscule.
Right.
you know, it was down to 0.01% at one point, which is basically nothing. It is as close to nothing as you could possibly get. But what it does is it makes them look for more riskier assets, because the riskier assets pay a higher return. So it's called a number of things. The Dash for Trash is one of my favorite names for this. Insurance companies, pension funds, individual investors are getting into riskier and riskier assets, junk bonds, high yield junk loans, leveraged loans, ETFs that CLOs, collateralized loan obligations that deal in risky stuff. How risky? We don't really know how risky, because right now we're in an environment where companies that might be that under normal circumstances, now to put those rabbit quotation marks over the normal, under normal circumstances where you have an interest rate of maybe 3, 4, 5%, these companies would just be out of business. They are underwater, but because the interest rates are so low, they're able to refinance their debts and get a better deal and survive. So when the tide changes just a bit, some of these companies might not be able to pay their debts any longer. They've got very, very low credit scores from the credit rating companies. And, you know, do mom and pop, do even the big pension funds and the insurance companies know exactly what they're getting into, and will they be able to get out of it when the tide turns? This is something that is concerning to me and to some of my colleagues here at Bloomberg News. We've been writing about it. There's a certain complacency right now where any company, any country, for instance, Ecuador, which defaulted in 2008 and whose president says, you know, the creditors are monsters. It's socialistic government there. They've been able to borrow money on the global credit markets. You know, you can go on and on and on. Real estate firms, builders in China that have negative cash flow up the wazoo are able to tap international credit markets for money. What's happening right now is that anybody who asks is getting a loan. Not necessarily a great thing under any circumstance. But they're able to get away with it now because of the endless bailout of the United States banking system by the Federal Reserve.
And you know, the option, or I guess, I don't know if, I mean, it was on the table at one point, was not just simply a bailout of the banks, but it could have been a direct bailout to the homeowners. And we would not have had this problem, but for, if you believe the sense that, well, then you're going to create, I guess, a lot of people who continue to go out and buy houses that they can't afford, which doesn't really make sense to me. But, I mean, that moral hazard. I mean, that wasn't that ultimately the choice that we had at that point? We could either bail out the banks by bailing out homeowners, or we could bail out the banks by simply bailing out the banks and leaving the homeowners to, I guess, just hope that the banks would be do the right thing.
I think a decision was made pretty early on, Sam. You know, that among the you know, listen, in the last days of the George W. Bush administration, it almost seemed as if Henry Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, was in charge, and he's a banker. And you know, I don't necessarily fault him for this. You know, his colleagues Tim Geithner, who is the president of the New York Federal Reserve, and Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, they made a decision very early on that. That they were going to go top down, that they were going to bail out the banks, and the banks were basically a proxy for the U.S. financial system. And, you know, we can't really turn back the clock. You know, it would be nice to be one of those Marvel comics, you know, what if, and have the Marvel writers and artists go back to 2007, 2008. What would have happened if we had done a bottom-up bailout? It would have been completely different, I think. But what we bought with that bailout was we certainly did prevent catastrophe. What we got in exchange, though, I think, was a long, long time of sluggish
Right. I mean, in some ways, we sort of amortized the catastrophe, right? And I should say, too, that, you know, Barney Frank has been quoted in numerous places, and I think he said so on this program at one point, that apparently Paulson had said, we will engage in that bottom up if we have a sign off from President-elect Obama at that time. And yeah. The Obama administration people would not give it. And so I'm not sure that Paulson would have wanted it any other way, but certainly it was on the table, it seems.
It's fascinating to me. Ron Susskind wrote a book, Confidence Men, mm-hmm. I think it's called. It's about the early days of the Obama administration. It's about the healthcare reform as well as the bank bailouts. And he comes closest, from what I've read, of describing this kind of Svengali effect that Tim Geithner had on President Obama. I'm not really sure where it came from or why, but it seemed as if Tim Geithner was able to get his way in the early days of the Obama administration. I think that folks like me expected differently, but perhaps you're in this camp too, Sam. When you heard that Tim Geithner was the choice for Treasury Secretary, you said, uh-oh, we're going in a way that we didn't expect. I'm not really sure if things that would have changed all that much if George W. Bush had gotten a third term. As far as this particular policy right. issue is concerned, a lot of other things would have been different, of course. But when it comes to the banks and the financial system, I'm not sure things would have been all that different had George W. Bush been elected to a third term.
Well, on that note, Bob Ivory, the book is Seven Sins of Wall Street.
Tell him it's not completely depressing, okay? Tell him I try to be funny and there's some nice anecdotes in there, and it's not a book that you put down and you want to jump off the bridge.
No, I mean I think it's a very important book, I think, to that fills out a lot of what has happened since 08, and we will link to it on the front page of majority.fm. Bob, I really appreciate your time today.
It's been a lot of fun. Thanks, Sam.
All right. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. I don't know. I mean, I guess it is fun, but
it's like there would be absolutely no difference if George W. Bush had gotten a third term. But that said, there's a lot of fun in this value.
I mean,
we're headed to a new financial crisis because we never held a criminal class of people. Mega banks accountable for anything. But there's also anecdotes.
I don't know. Maybe, you know, I mean, I think, you know, the value of this, again, is, I think, really is in preparing for the next one, really, in many respects. And the more that we can get the sense out there that we missed the boat. But that's basically the best way to, I think, to present it. I mean, we could have done a bottom-up rescue of the economy, the financial system, the banks, even if you wanted to say it that way. But instead, we did a top-down and hoping that the banks would, you know, provide this golden shower once they were saved. And sadly, they did not. All right, we're going to take a break, head into the funner half. In the fun half, going to show you rabid conservative right-wingers really how to run a populist movement with the kids. And they're doing it in Britain.
With some shout-outs to the past.
Yeah, I have to say, it's really sort of scary.
It is an amazing video. I think it's just stunning.
And it's based upon this guy, of course, one of these British National Party youth members admonishing his dog on Facebook. We will get to that. Also, We'll break down the Halbig v. Burwell. It was formerly Halbig v. Sebelius case. This is the case where three members of a judicial panel, I should say, or three members of the U.S. Court of Appeals District of Columbia Circuit on a 2-1 vote found that, and I think we have covered this quite a bit over the past couple of weeks, that as drafted, the Affordable Care Act does not allow for subsidies in those exchanges that are run by the federal government. So you're talking about 33, I think it is, 30-some-odd subsidies where the states did not have the capacity to set up their own exchanges or decided not to, had the federal government do it. In those exchanges, as is with the other 17 exchanges by, I think it's 16 or 17 states that did set up their exchanges, people who have incomes at 133% of poverty, all the way up to 400% of poverty, get subsidies from the federal government. In the drafting of the law, it says that subsidies are available to people who sign up for exchanges established by the state. Now, if you look at the law in its totality and in other situations, of course, the law would make no sense as drafted, because Obama, the entire system cannot succeed without the subsidies. If you don't have the subsidies, people between 133% and 400% of poverty, millions of people, would not be available for subsidies. They would not be able to buy insurance. The cost of insurance for everybody else would go up. The whole system would collapse. To believe that these two justices are right in their reading of this law, when intent seems so obvious, one would have to believe that Congress wrote a law that they knew would fail. Now, the government will appeal. It will go to the U.S. Court of Appeals, District of Columbia Circuit. And I keep repeating the name of that court because you'll recall an earlier story. It will go to the entire court en banc, as they say. I'm mispronouncing that, undoubtedly. Where there are 11 justices, 7 of whom were appointed by Democrats, 4 of whom were appointed by Republicans. I think it's got to be obvious to you that those three on the panel, 2 were appointed by Republicans, 1 by a Democrat. Those two huge, already on record saying that they felt the Affordable Care Act was a bad law. The entire court, I'm sure, not sure, but is very likely to rule like early lower courts have, that this was clearly a drafting error. The intent of the bill is such that everybody participating in an exchange would be available for subsidies. Then the question is whether or not the Supreme Court will look at this matter. Now, a reminder. We were only, what was it, 6-8 months ago, maybe it was a year ago now, where Republicans were refusing to confirm President Obama's nominees to this same court, arguing that 11 was too many. You don't need 11 justices there. We should keep it at 8. And didn't want to seat these 4 other Democratic appointees. Well, the filibuster reform happened at the beginning of the year. Those justices are now seated, and I think it's going to have an implication on this ruling. So we will talk more about this, and we'll probably have somebody on either tomorrow or the next day to do a deep dive into this. But just remember, this is the way it's going to go. It's going to head to the full court. They will probably find that the intent of the law is such that everyone who buys insurance through the exchanges is eligible for the subsidies. And then the question is, will the Supreme Court take it? So we're not going to put a pin in it, but put a pin in your panic. All right, let's head to the funner half. We will take your phone calls, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We'll take your IMs. I will talk about the controversy about where Netroots Nation is going to be next week. I will give my final thoughts. Next week is next year, I meant. I will give my final thoughts. We also have a bunch of interviews from Netroots that I did do that we will be using for vacation in a couple of weeks. And I may pepper throughout the between now and then. Just a reminder, this show relies heavily on, well, not just heavily, basically totally, on members' memberships. You can become a member at majority.fm. Really, it is your support that makes this possible day in, day out. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. You can get the Majority Report blend. You can get 10% off by using the coupon code MAJORITY. Also, free beers. Know that on Thursday we ran an ad from Harry's.com. We're going to run one more ad from them, I think, next week. Use the coupon code Majority Report there. They give you a break on the shaving stuff. Hear that? That's smooth. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Come back with the funner half of the program.
Hey.